Welcome to tonight's broadcast of All Things Cage. You're listening to Wave Farm's WGXC 90.7 FM, radio for open ears, and I'll be your host, Laura Kuhn, longtime director of the John Cage Trust. My guest this week is Emily Martin, my right arm here at the John Cage Trust for now well over a decade. Emmy and I created this program back in October 2020 as a way of testing the technology and our manner of using it. As it turned out, our conversation quickly led us into the subject of the inception and history of the John Cage Trust, as well as a bit about our past and present work. Hence, it made me think it might work well as a kind of primer program on the John Cage Trust for uninitiated listeners at All Things Cage. Good morning, Emmy. How are you?
Good morning. I'm okay. How are
you? Good. It's a beautiful day here in the Hudson Valley. The John Cage Trust, for those of you who don't know, is situated at Bard College, where we've been since 2007. Emmy, I'm going to take a moment and inform our audience a little bit about the background of the John Cage Trust, which will lead me right into when you entered the picture. Mm-hmm. So the John Cage Trust was formed in 1993, which is 1 year after John Cage died. He died in August of 1993, in 92. In 93, having really gathered together all of the materials that Cage had left behind, we decided to create an entity, we meaning me and Merce Cunningham primarily. We brought together a group of affiliated people, David Vaughn, who was the archivist at the Merce Cunningham Dance Foundation, and Anne Darningcourt, who was then the director of the Philadelphia Museum of Art. So Anne represented visual art, I represented music, Merce represented dance and collaborative work with John Cage, and David Vaughn represented archives, really, and dance archives in particular. It was a small board. Merce laughingly said that we should only have four people, that way we had to agree. Because a split vote is very easy when you have an even number of board members. So that was our initial board. It was just me at the helm, and I was the chief bottle washer and everything for 14 years. When we first created the John Cage Trust, it was decided that we would file for nonprofit status, which we did right away, and that was granted. We then decided to find, I was at the time living in Arizona and teaching at Arizona State University West in a small, very new but very small interdisciplinary arts program. So living in Phoenix and kind of bouncing back and forth, which I had done for years after having worked with Cage personally until about, 1990, in New York City until 89. And then bouncing back and forth kind of between 89 and his death in 92. So we decided to find a space for the John Cage Trust in New York City, which was a loft space in the old Postal Archives building at 666 Greenwich Street, just off of Christopher, right in the West Village. It was a big space that had two rooms in the downstairs, very large rooms, small, tiny kitchen downstairs, and a bedroom upstairs for me, bathrooms on both floors. And that's where the John Cage Trust lived from 1993 until about late 2001, early 2002. For those of you in New York, it makes sense for you to hear that in late 2001, that is to say post 9/11, there was nothing to rent, and the archive building replaced the subflooring and doubled our rent. And so since we were off lease at that point, we decided to move. However, we couldn't find any place to go because everybody who had been downtown, given the devastation of the World Trade Center and the towers, the Twin Towers, moved uptown or in proximity to New York City. So we couldn't find any place to go. And so we essentially, as a board of people, myself, David Vaughn, Merce Cunningham, and Darningcourt, decided that we would put non-essential archival materials in storage and that I would go back to Phoenix and just do some pure archival work, which is what I did. We also at that time made an agreement between us that I would find us a permanent home within about 5 years. We had grown really too large to be alone, and yet we were still too small, really, to not ally ourselves. So it made sense to find a permanent place for us to live. But for the moment, we just moved the working archives to Arizona with me. Our rent, just to give you an idea, was a proposed $4,800 a month in New York City. And the space I was able to rent in Arizona was $270. So it was a very big, big difference. So off I went to Arizona. And since I had lived there before, I knew Arizona very well. I knew Phoenix very well. I had a place to live still there. So everything was easy, very easy. Interestingly, it was almost 5 years to the day that we found a new home. And that new home was at Bard College. That was after looking at a number of places on the West Coast, all really in vain in a way, because John Cage was very much a New York person, despite the fact that, by the way, he came from Los Angeles. So while everybody on the West Coast certainly knew him, there was no really appropriate place to place his archives. It was Mark Swed, the music critic at the LA Times at the time, who suggested Leon Botstein and recommended Bard. So I reached out to Leon, and Leon was extremely responsive. And I met with him in the dead of winter in whatever year that was, I guess it was 2006, had shown up with my little briefcase and my patent leather shoes and my ready to give a presentation to these four men, by the way, all sitting in Leon's den full of cigar smoke. I just kind of cleared my throat and I said, well, how should we begin? I mean, I could give a presentation. And Leon touched my hand with his and he said, oh, please don't. And I thought, oh my God, this is my kind of guy, you know? And I said, oh, okay, what would you like? And he said, Laura, you want to be here. I want you to be here. Let's just figure out how to get our respective boards to agree. And that's really how it all began. He was particularly happy to hear that we didn't need anything except space. I didn't need a salary. I was paid by the John Cage Trust. We really didn't need anything. We just needed real estate for our materials and to do our work. And after really looking around for quite a while on the campus for a couple of months, our boards having agreed by this time, by the way, we decided that we would be not on campus proper, but slightly off campus, very close to the Fisher Center for the Performing Arts, in a house that was situated on a little tiny street called Old Wheelsback Road. And this was the Dick Griffith's house. A lot of these houses that were slightly off campus, or a few that are on campus, are named for their donors. So they're named for people who inhabited those houses and upon their own deaths left the buildings to the college. So I moved the trust back into New York State, but this time into Griffith's house on Old Wheelsback Road in the middle of winter. I lived there myself for a couple of months until I got the archives sort of situated, and then moved out and to an appropriate place off campus. Now we get to the point where Emmy enters the picture. So 2007, one of our strongest allies on the campus, really one of a great friend, but and a key person to the Bard community at large, happened to be Bob Martin, Robert Martin, who was the head of the conservatory and really a right arm to Leon Botstein. And he also happened to be Emmy Martin's father. Now, that is not to say that Emmy got the job at the Cage Trust because her father was Bob Martin, but rather that it was his thought. Emmy was wanting to make a career change, and it was his thought that it might be useful for her to have a conversation with me. So we had a conversation. Emmy, I'm going to let you speak a little bit now. What were you doing right before you came to the Cage Trust?
I was living in New York. I was living in Brooklyn and working in Manhattan in music publishing at Carl Fisher.
Uh-huh. And what were you doing at Fisher?
I was doing a lot of sales. So it at first attracted me, but then I realized very quickly I was not really working with anyone except sales teams. So I wanted to expand and do something else. And I was really interested in the idea of arts management because I have amateur music background, and I grew up with my father, who's a cellist and director of the conservatory at the time. So I really wanted to be around artists, and I wanted to be around people who were out in the world. I was very interested to meet you because I knew a little bit about, I mean, not much, but I knew a little bit about your career and how you didn't have a set list of things that you did for your job, but you were kind of being able to explore other people's ideas within John Cage, and all of that was really exciting. So when you invited me to dinner, that was probably the dinner that changed my course.
I see. It's funny that it's true. I, like you, really didn't enter John Cage's world after his death it wasn't anything I had expected. You know, I wasn't groomed to be an archivist. I really didn't know much about archives other than that I held graduate degrees and had worked in archives to do my own research. But in terms of running an archive, I really had to wing it. I had to learn as I went along. But one of the things that makes, I think, our lives so interesting is that we represent an artist who himself loved the idea of letting the task in front of you guide your steps, as opposed to having the steps be imposed upon the job, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And that's very, very Cagean. That idea is very Cagean. So that the archives, I often get people, for example, say to me, they need permission for something, or they want to look at something or whatever. And I'll have a short conversation with them, and then I'll say, yeah, I'm sure we can accommodate that. And they say, really? That's it? Mm-hmm. You know, they're shocked at how amenable or how open we are to them. Now, part of that is that as an archive, as you well know, we don't have a lot of rare material. You know, we do, of course, have our art collection. We do, of course, have some manuscripts. But all of Cage's music manuscripts, for example, are an archive copy. So we don't have to impose kind of archival standards 90% of the time on people who come in. We do have to be careful of copyright, of course.
Right.
That's the only way really that we can get into trouble. So Emmy, it's a very sweet story, I think, in a way. When Emmy called, or I reached out to her, I think, I don't remember which, but whatever it was, I was at Merce's apartment that entire week and preparing a dinner party for Merce and a very, very close friend of his, a celebrated poet and a writer, a playwright in Venezuela named Isaac Chacron. And I just thought, well, I wonder if, because I really didn't have time to take a separate meeting with Emmy, but I thought, why doesn't Emmy just come to dinner? That would balance out, we have two men and two women, it would balance out a nice dinner party. So I asked you if you would come to dinner. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really tell you much else. I told you maybe a little bit about who Isaac was, and I don't think at this point you had met Merce, had you?
No, I had not.
No, and certainly hadn't met Isaac, because Isaac was not in New York very often. Anyway, so Emmy said she would come to dinner. So Emmy comes to dinner, and there's Merce, who's just adorable. And Emmy is just Emmy. And that was the first time she and I had met as well. So we had talked on the phone, but we had never been together. So she helped me cook, and we just got to know each other really quickly. And Merce was Merce. He was just, you know, hobbling around his apartment. Okay, and we were waiting for Isaac, and Emmy, so it really wasn't until the end of the evening when I had watched Emmy in situ, if you will, with these two very, very famous people, these two very close friends, Merce and Isaac. And Emmy remained confident and calm and not in any way kowtowing to them in the way that she spoke to them. She spoke to them like human beings and friends. And And she just fit right in. And I thought, wow, you know, you can't teach someone how to do that, or it's very hard to teach someone how to do that. And you weren't in any way that way. And so by the end of the evening, maybe even Isak had left, or maybe Merce and Isak were looking at Merce's computer. That was probably more likely. And I just had the thought, I said, Emmy, you know, would you be interested in coming to work with me at Bard, you know, the John Cage Trust? I could use help. I don't think this had crossed her mind to return to the kind of place of where her parents were, you know, to return so quickly. How old were you, Emmy, at that time?
I was 27.
27. So you were old enough to know your own mind, but you hadn't been out of the cradle that long.
Right. And I had never sort of contemplated leaving New York. It was just sort of, I imagined definitely trying to get a different path and work, but it never occurred to me to leave the city until you brought that up.
Yeah. And my favorite part of the story was when you said that you would definitely want to think about it. And I said, do, you know, and if I can answer any questions in the meantime, you know, let me know. And you said, you thought about that, and you were kind of quiet for about 10, 20 minutes. And then you said, well, what exactly would I do? And I said, everything.
Yeah, and I was sold. That was the perfect answer. Yeah.
And it's really true. You know, it's like we all take out the garbage. We all do the dishes. We all make the appointments. We all meet with archivists. We all do the filing. Actually, I mostly do the filing. And anyway, that's kind of how, you know, this duo was born. Emmy is now celebrating year 13 with the John Cage Trust. And we're still mostly friends, right?
Yes.
We know each other very well. We've traveled the world together. We've been, you know, to Europe several times together. So here we are, year 13. Certainly things have changed a great deal. The John Cage Trust existed in Griffith's House until 2018. So we were in Griffith's House for 11 years. And by the way, you have to picture it. You can see pictures of Griffith's House on our website at johncage.org. Emmy, by the way, is a fantastic photographer. So a lot of the photographs that you see on the website, Emmy has taken those. She's also, her work has graced a number of books that I've done. Anyway, she's a great photographer. So if you go to johncage.org, you can see some of the pictures. It dawns on me, Emmy, that we're really remiss in not replacing those.
Right. I know, we should.
It's on the page of johncage.org, our website, that says about the John Cage Trust. And there are pictures that frame kind of this whole kind of narrative about the trust, where you can read everything I've just said, but in a little more detail, and probably with less ums and better punctuation. But we were there until we just were bursting at the seams. So it was really in 2017 that we realized that we were spending more from our meager budget on storage than for any other, you know, external, outside of payroll, of course, and things like that. But we were just paying this enormous amount of money every month for storage. And I don't think I'm exaggerating to say that not a week went by that you weren't having to go across the river to some one or another storage space to pull something, to locate something. It had just become untenable.
Yeah, I mean, at that point we had 5 external storage units. And so depending on different requests that were coming in each day, I could spend easily a couple hours back and forth grabbing something. So it worked, but it was too spread out.
Yeah. So we decided that we needed more space. We needed more space. And frankly, we also wanted to be on the campus proper. We wanted to be in the flow of the campus community as opposed to just across 9G, which is a tiny little, you know, I don't even know what to call it. What is 9G?
I mean, locally it's our highway, but it's
just really a one lane.
It's a very simple county road.
But so yes, it is a highway, but we were right on the other side of it, which is significant in the campus community, that we were off campus. Once we moved on campus, which I'll get to in a second, our foot traffic increased a great deal because people, students in particular, didn't have to walk across a nasty highway where they don't die frequently. But we've had a couple of deaths since I've been at Bard, since we've been at Bard on 9G, of people trying to get across the road. People drive like maniacs up here because they can. Anyway, talking to, going back to Leon, our president, in probably early 2017, really with this request that we needed more space. And we began to look on campus. Where did we look, Emmy? Do you recall?
We looked at a barn storage at Montgomery Place campus, which Bard had just purchased, the Montgomery Place Estates, which is adding 300 acres to the campus. So it's a very exciting addition, but it was going to take a lot of time and work to kind of acclimate to be both campuses. So they did offer us a little space there, but it wasn't enough for everything to be together. Then we also looked at a house, or a building rather, across 9G that sort of was more space, but it didn't solve our issue of wanting to be part of the main campus.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I also recall one of our objectives, going back to our archives, is that we wanted, for the first time in a really long time, to have all of our archives with us. So that was a really strong drive for our space. And as I recall, that barn on Montgomery Place barn, it would have cost more than the barn was worth to put in a fire suppressant for our art collection.
Yes.
I think. So that was kind of a non-starter in a way, because it meant that that art collection was going to remain splintered and in various locations.
Right.
And then one day we got a knock on the door and there was a house opening up. So tell everybody about Wilson House, where we are now.
So Wilson House is a beautiful house that's set back. It's on the main campus down a long driveway. It's surrounded by woods. It had, when we first came to look at it, we were sort of taken aback because it was really large, but it was hard to visualize as an archive space because it was both a personal home and office space for visitors who worked on Bard's behalf remotely, and they would come back often to do like a week of work and stay here. So every room had couches and mattresses. But we walked around and it's just a perfect situation where the basement was raw and it was ready to be finished. So that would add probably, I don't know the square footage, but it let us bring our art collection together. So immediately knowing that, we thought we could make this work. The first floor of the Wilson House is beautiful. It's very open, lots of windows. We have a grand piano in there now, so we can have events and we can have concerts or gatherings for book readings or classrooms. The second floor is where we have our research area, and we have our John Cage Trust Library, which is continually growing. And so that takes up one room. We also have our shared office for me and Laura,
which is huge, by the way.
Yeah, which is very, very large. And
Emmy gets the window.
Yes, I get the window.
I'm in the corner. I don't know how that happened.
We have a room that's dedicated to the photo archive and our text manuscript. And on the third floor, it's a beautiful open space, technically not a workspace, but we're able to keep John Cage's personal library safe and on the shelves, as well as a lot of extra print material that we have from various projects we've done.
Right. That third floor is such a sweet little floor. It has a deck off of it, but it is what they call in the trade or in the building and grounds world, a non-occupancy floor.
Right.
Because there's no egress. There's no way off of the building. If there should be a fire, there is no way out other than to walk into a fire. And we did get a bid for an external, what do you call that, like stairs to go from the third floor down, but it was I forget even now, $40,000-$50,000.
Yeah.
And it destroyed the beauty of that whole side of the house. It would have when we saw the architect drawings. So we just decided to comply. And that the third floor is actually, it serves us very nicely because it has a lot of archive materials that are accessed less frequently than the archive materials on the main floor, on the second floor, which is our main archive room, in addition to Cage's library, which we would not let people peruse anyway. We treat it like a call only library. So people can look up, the library is fully documented, it's fully cataloged online. They can request to see particular volumes and we will retrieve them and bring them into the main research room, which is on the second floor, and keep an eye on them so they don't walk away. Yeah, so we had to, what Emmy was getting at is that we had to really make the house archive ready. And that took us, I don't know, 6-7 months, mm-hmm. pretty much from start to finish. We had to put in air conditioning, for example. There was no AC in the building at all. We did put in fire suppression on the on the basement level, which houses our John Cage permanent art collection, which is Cage's own works. It's also, because of the fire suppression, it's also home to a lot of audio materials, things that need to stay cool, and we just wouldn't want them to go up and melt.
Right.
So a lot of archival audio things, most of which have been transferred, if not all. I'm trying to think if there's anything else to say in particular about the archives. As I say, the archives, Emmy alluded to it, the archives started really as anything that John Cage himself had amassed over his life. And for any of you who know anything about Cage's biography, he started as a composer very young. So we're really, and died at just shy of 80. So he was 79 years old. So we're looking at about 60 years of materials that he had amassed, including the entire music manuscript collection, which had to be cataloged, as I said before, after he died, which totaled something like just shy of 28,000 pieces of paper. This was in his apartment that he shared with Merce. Merce also let us pick and choose a permanent art collection from all of the work that was either in their loft, their shared loft on 18th Street, or else with Marguerite Roeder, who had the works for sale. She was the gallerist to Cage for a very, very long time, since the sort of early 70s, still is the gallerist, but became Merce's gallerist when he became more active as a visual artist and began to make his fanciful drawings in particular. So Merce very generously let us pull together a permanent collection of things that would not be sold and that would simply go on tour. The works would go on tour. They would be lent to institutions around the world, which has happened a great deal. Mm-hmm. Probably the largest exhibition that we've had was in 2009-2010, the season 9-10. It was for the show called Every Day is a Good Day. And it was a traveling exhibition in the UK. So there were, I forget exactly the number of venues, 6 or 7 venues, where these works, almost our entire art collection, went on tour.
Yeah.
For months. It was really spectacular. And it was called Every Day is a Good Day. The curator was Jeremy Miller, spelled M-I-L-L-A-R. And Jeremy conceived a show, a traveling show, which in each location opened different than the place before it, the venue before it, and it also changed on a set basis, depending on what the venue could tolerate. If they could do it every day, it would change every day. So that it kind of, Cage would have loved this show. He would have loved it because it was a traveling exhibition that really defied the essence of a traveling exhibition. You know, you're talking to someone and you say, oh, did you see the, you know, Eve Klein show at MoMA? And somebody would say, no, but I saw it when it came to LA. And say, oh, it was marvelous, wasn't it? And you could share very, very particular things about this. The only thing that was different in that, in the case of an Eve Klein show, would have been the walls and the space and the city that it was in. But in the case of Every Day is a Good Day, the show changed on a daily basis. So people would, and there were little special, I won't go into this, we could spend an hour talking about archives and, I mean, about art collections and how they're shown. But it was a fantastic, fantastic thing. But all those artworks had gone away and then they all came back and we had no place to put them. So it was really nice when they were gone for a little while. Anyway, so now we have our art collection with us. We have, what else do we have? We have program files, which Emmy right now is spending a great deal of her time with. Emmy, talk about the program files.
So we have, I don't even know. I would say maybe 30 archive boxes of program files that started from the 1930s up until today and is continually growing as more concerts and programs happen around the world. So I have a very massive job right now of cataloging these to sort of be able to put them in some order. Because right now they are in order, but just physically in each box. So if someone calls and says they want to see a program from a music circus in Denmark in 1972, I have to really hope that it's really filed in that way, because there's no sort of master list, which is what I'm creating now, which will be very
helpful. Right. It's heroic. It's a heroic job. It's also, I have to say that this is, Emmy's embarking on one small piece of a project that has is underway for us, and that is to make as much of our archives accessible to people online. Not so much to download and use, but as reference points when they're doing their own work. This is particularly true right now, where this is early October 2020, you know, for posterity, it's probably fair to say that, or right to say that we are still in a COVID situation. So we do not have a huge number of people coming through. We also don't have a huge number of people that are traveling freely around the world. So we get a lot of requests. One rule, when Emmy, I gave Emmy all my 10 commandments when she first came on. And one of them, which I've always stuck to until this year, but one of the 10 commandments is we don't do other people's work. You know, so if somebody says, oh, I want to, I'm just going to give you an example. Someone would say, I want to do a piece, or I want to do a doctoral dissertation on Cage's works as they've been performed in the Southwest. We would not then go to all of our program files, figure out which ones were from the Southwest, no matter how well organized,
right,
and do that for them and then tell them what that is. But we would invite them to come and spend time with the programs so they could glean what they could glean from our materials. But people can't move about as freely. And one doesn't want to see research into Cage stop or even slow down, because it's so useful and so lovely to spend time with Cage's work. It really has a transformational effect on people's lives to work with John Cage's materials. I know certainly it has changed my life, and I've been doing this for a very long time, and I still feel changed on a daily basis in working with material. I learn something new every day, just stumbling upon a composition that I never really paid attention to before, knowing it's bare bones, if you will, and then all of a sudden realizing how it was put together and what Cage, where it fit in his life, and what was he, you know, working on at the time. I'm constantly amazed and enchanted, frankly. So we don't want that to stop, you know, we don't want that to stop. So Emmy's doing the really heroic job of taking one aspect of our archives, the program files, and scanning them, each one separately, and documenting what those hold, so that information, given that people can't come here. So Emmy's doing research for everybody right now. You can think of it that way. What else are we up to right now?
Right now, well, I'm also working on our John Cage Trust Library. So as you mentioned, Cage's personal library, which comprises of everything found on his bookcases at the time of his death in 1992, that is a closed library that we now have on the third floor. And it's online at johncage.org. And so we have our John Cage Trust Library, which continually grows. And also we'd like to get that public, so people have an idea of what's here, so they're able to ask specific questions with the materials, or when we're open to the public again, be able to come and use those materials in person. So that's also, you know, right now I'm scanning each book cover, adding it to our database, and that'll be really great when both of those collections are online, because that will give people a real sense of material that a lot of these books are quite special, and exhibition books from 30 years ago, and things that are really hard to find. So we want to be able to have people be able to use this in their work.
Again, they're not really, they're not books that people check out, but they are books that are available to them to peruse. The database that we're working on is, the database itself is near done. It's where Emmy's working on the scans of the covers now, so people can see what books look like. And I'm writing the text to describe the innards of them as best I can. So we spend a lot of time right now doing things for this enhanced web presence of the Cage Trust. I think in this year in particular, and certainly since March, we have learned the value, I won't say the supreme value because it has its limitations, but we've certainly learned the value of things online, of things that, you know, at least essential information be available to us. So we've sharpened our energy in that direction as well. What else? Emmy, how did you, let's go back to you a little bit, just personally. So you didn't know a whole lot about John Cage when you first came and started working with me. How did you make yourself comfortable with him?
It was really, I mean, for me, I think when we have people who come and request to do work with us, whether they're just John Cage fans and they just love John Cage and there's an aspect that they want to take a closer look at, my assisting them really helped me also take a closer look at that. So I feel like a lot of what I've learned has been through working with visitors and working with scholars and artists and people who want to take a closer look, because often I don't have a lot of time to randomly just look around the archive and spend a week going through things that I had never thought to do. But as my work asks me to go and assist various projects, that's also my learning time, where I can dive deeper and get a better understanding of what was happening in the world at the time, what was happening in Cage's life at the time. And like you said, how everything in Cage's orbit is so interconnected. So I'm learning new things all the time. And it's great, because I feel like every project we get to assist with, it's also just a huge learning in my own personal database.
I remember with great fondness in your early years, you probably don't even, this, it was so long ago and so such a little thing, but you used to take books home from the library. So you'd say, you know, you'd have two of his books, you know, at first, and then you would start saying, oh, or I would go to look for a book on the shelves and I'd say, Emmy, this book is missing. And you'd say, oh, I took it home. I'm sorry, I'm reading it.
Yes, yeah.
And by the way, there's no better way to learn an archive than to handle the materials of the archive. I laughingly say, and there's a little grain of truth to it, that, oh, Emmy knows the archives a little better than I do these days, you know, so I can say, Emmy, can you get your hands on blah, whatever it might be? And you say, yeah, hang on. And, you know, you come back with it. I actually drive Emmy completely insane sometimes when we have a scholar that I'm working with, where she's working on the third floor and I'm on the first floor with this scholar. And I say, Emmy, can you find block? And she goes, okay. And she runs down three flights of stairs with whatever it is I'm looking for. Anyway,
But that's why it's such a perfect combination, because you can know on the top of your head the materials to pull. And then once I grab them, then I learn what's in them from, you know, that. So it's a good balance, I think.
Yeah, I have to say that's absolutely true. And I think, Emmy, though, I'm really impressed at how quickly, and when I say quickly, I mean 4 or 5 years, how quickly you, never having met John Cage, never really spent time with his work prior to working at the Cage Trust, how quickly you came to, I don't even know how to say what I'm trying to say, how quickly you came to understand what Cage's position might be about something. Because that's often a kind of question that surfaces from visitors, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, where they'll posit an idea about something. And you'll find me often saying, oh, that's right on, or saying that doesn't ring true. You know, that Cage wouldn't feel that way. He wouldn't have done it that way. And then have to back up why I was saying that. But I see you doing that now quite naturally. I always feel like I was just sort of blessed that I got to work with Cage and I saw this, you know, up close and personal. But I think you've learned it. You know, you've learned to intuit, in a way, how Cage might deal with things. Or anyway, you get my point. You get my point.
Yeah, no, it's true. I mean, it's funny. I sometimes think about how interesting it is that I never met John Cage, and yet every day I am able to work within his world. And it is, sometimes it is very funny, because sometimes I do feel very close to it, but it's all through learning from your experience and learning from spending time in the archive and spending time with the material. It's kind of amazing. I feel like I, in a way, I do get to know him, even though I never got to meet him.
I think I'm kind of staying on this subject a little bit, because I meet from time to time young people who would really like to get started in archival work. They'd really like to work in a nonprofit that represents some person or some group of people or some art form or whatever. And they just don't feel like they there's no place for them to go to learn that. And I'm not sure that there is a place to go to learn that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I remember, do you remember, we had a young intern for a while named Robin, and she was a senior at the Bard music program, and she really wanted to do archival work having to do with our music manuscript collection, to which I said, you're out of luck, it's all done. You know, that we had spent, I spent four or five months with a group of, a team really, of international scholars. There were four of us. One from Germany, one from Hungary, and two from America. I'm missing one. Oh, and one from the Netherlands. So there were five of us, actually, two Americans, me and James Pritchett. 5 months of cataloging that and putting it in a state. It then was placed at the New York Public Library, these 28,000 pieces of paper. And yeah, I'm telling you, it's pretty much what we did. You know, with very rare exception, there are very few errors that, you know, it's very clean. Anyway, so she wanted to do that, and that was done. So there wasn't any work for her, but she really, really wanted to join us. And so we decided to let her do a rough cut, a first right attempt at organizing the text manuscripts, which hadn't been done. Now, anybody who knows John Cage's work knows that just as in music, Cage introduced ways of working in his writings as he got older in his misostic forms, which started really back in the 60s, in this kind of way of working that was novel. There weren't a whole body of people writing in this way. And so poor, poor Robin. She went to on-campus library people to talk about how she would create, you know, this catalog and how she would organize her materials, except that all the advice she got was from traditional poetry or traditional writers.
Right. Yeah.
Which of course didn't fly for poor John Cage. And once she understood that the materials want to drive your work, they tell you how to organize them if you just open your eyes, you know, if you just look at what's in front of you, even if it's a unique organization for the institution that you're working with. And that's a big lesson. You know, if one can get their head around that, you really are in a very creative position in the John Cage Trust Archives all the time, because you're constantly having to make up how you're going to do something. What's the best way to do this with these materials? So I think that's really fun. You know, it's, I guess, not for everybody. You know, it wouldn't be fun for people who don't like to make up stuff, you know.
Right.
And a lot of people don't, you know, a lot of people would much rather have a system that you learn, and then that system feeds everything, you know, anyway. So, well, it's really great talking to you. We never get to actually talk like this, like our
history. Nice.
So what else is left for us? I guess right now, I mean, with COVID, as I said, we're doing a great deal of work with our web work, and we're doing a lot of research for other people, mm-hmm. which is one of my 10 thou shalt nots. But right now, until we're, you know, tap dancing very fast, but until we're tap dancing even faster, I'd love to get as much information as we can get up online so that we don't continue doing other people's work. Not because we're lazy, because we're not, but because it's valuable to go through masses of materials to find those little kernels of things that apply to what your interest is. You know, discovery is part of the joy of research. Anyway, let's close here, but think to do another program about the John Cage Trust for All Things Cage, since it strikes me that we haven't covered but a fraction of our archives and our work. But for now, let's move on in the time we have left to play something from our archives. Let's listen to a recording captured at our 2009 symposium here at Bard College, which was called John Cage at Bard College. We were still the new kids at Bard in 2009, and this symposium meant to reveal what kind of expertise and interest there might already be at Bard by soliciting presentations and performances by our colleagues, faculty, administration, and students. I'm going to play a movement from Eric Salzman's 1996-1997 Five Dances, which was an arrangement he made for string quartet of five works Cage originally composed for prepared piano, and incidentally were all written for dance. One of the five dances arranged by Salzman is Cage's In a Landscape, which dates from 1948, having been first performed by Cage himself at Black Mountain College. This piece is a chestnut in Cage's catalog. It's been performed and recorded by countless musicians. It is also among the many works that are offered as a masterclass at Tito Music, a revolutionary web resource and iPad app available from Edition Peters, which is John Cage's longtime music publisher. Adam Tendler, who lives in Brooklyn, is the featured teacher performer. Additionally, many of the works featured on Tito, including In a Landscape, have been issued in publications entitled More Than the Score. This is a series of classic piano music scores that individually cover essential works of the repertory, ranging from Bach through Mozart, Schubert, Mendelssohn, Chopin, and Debussy, right up to John Cage. Each volume focuses on one piece, and each includes a written masterclass and background information meant to encourage exploration of the music being presented beyond the printed score. In a Landscape has been arranged for various instruments, many recorded and commercially released. Noteworthy is Jacqueline Poloff's performance of the version for harp, which was an alternative instrumentation in Cage's original score, as is the performance by Aaron Larger Kaplan of his own arrangement for guitar. And Tad Anderson's marvelous arrangement for percussion also stands out in my mind. The scores for all three of these arrangements, harp, guitar, and percussion, are available from Edition Peters. The score for Eric Salzman's arrangement for string quartet is also available from Peters and is performed here by students from the Bard Conservatory, Feng Yue He, Yue Sun, Leah Gastler, and Laura Hendrickson, who came together as a quartet for the symposium. Their performance took place, as virtually all of the symposium performances took place, on the Sosnoff stage in Bard's Fisher Center for the Performing Arts. This was the world premiere of this work, and it's a beautiful, beautiful rendition.